My name's Matt, and I will be talking to John Collins about agile flexibility, cultural awareness, clear delegation, and pragmatic leadership.
Hey, hi, John. I'm really happy to have you here today. We'll talk about many years of your experience in engineering. I'm really hyped about it because you have the experience on from tech companies in Europe and from tech companies in US. So it's really hard to find somebody who worked for Microsoft, Apple, Flixbus, Vinted, Relier, and I think I forgot one more big corp.
Snapchat. But it's so great to be speaking with you today, and thank you so much for having the chance. To share some of my experiences with your audience.
Awesome. So, John, I really would like to start with the first question because, I'm based in Europe. I worked in Germany. I'm working with companies from the US. And I'm really interested about your experiences, Silicon Valley versus Germany, managing team, building team, the differences, if you could elaborate on that.
Yeah, for sure. So I worked at Microsoft and at Apple in the Silicon Valley. That's the San Francisco Bay Area. And I worked at a variety of mid-sized and smaller tech companies in Berlin, Germany. And yeah, I mean, we could probably be talking about this for hours, but just to kind of summarize for your audience, some of the main differences I see is one is the level of salary and stock options that are typically given in the US versus Germany. So I'd like to elaborate on that a little bit. So in the US, for a typical person working at a tech company, they're going to be given a base salary plus usually like an annual bonus of some kind and a level of stock. So the stock is, if the company is public, that means that they're on the stock market, they'll be getting a certain number of shares per year. And if the company is not public, like let's say it's a startup or it's an earlier stage company, they're going to be receiving stock options, which is usually the option to buy stock at a very discounted price. And then, but you take a risk with that. So maybe that company does well and you can do what's called exercising those stock options, which means that you can sell those stock options. Or if the company goes under, then those stock options can become worthless. In Germany, I think this is one of the big differences I saw is that stock is not necessarily a guarantee. Some companies offer it, but it's definitely not the standard as it is in the United States. In Germany, in terms of the salary and given the social safety net that the country affords, so for example, like how your taxes pay for college or how your taxes pay for early childhood care, how every person receives healthcare as part of living in the country, whether that means you're a citizen or a resident that's there on a temporary visa, you get all of these benefits by being in Germany. But in the US, a lot of these things are tied to either you have to pay for it out of pocket or like healthcare is tied to your employer. So it's not always like an apples to apples comparison when we're talking about the level of salary. Like some people will say, oh, Silicon Valley, it pays so much, but you have to spend a lot on housing. You have to spend a lot on healthcare. You have to spend a lot on childcare. While in Germany, yes, salaries are less, but those things are covered for within your taxes. There's also a few other major differences I've noticed. For example, like the average time at a company, especially around Silicon Valley, tends to be shorter. It's not unusual, for somebody to be working at a company for 1 to 2 years. While in Germany, I saw that employees tended to stay at companies a little bit longer. Of course, every person is different, every situation is different, but that was just kind of a general observation. And the level of government and laws that have employee protections is really different between the two places. So in Germany, usually you will have a probation period when somebody joins a company, whether that means that you're a junior employee or a vice president, you're probably going to have a probation period. 3 to 6 months is pretty standard. It could be longer. And after that probation period ends in Germany, it can be difficult to let somebody go if they're a low performer. There has to be like a lot of evidence towards it. There, you have to follow very strict rules in terms of the laws to make sure that the employees are protected accordingly. While in the United States, most states are at will employment, which is kind of like you're always under probation, basically. You can be let go for any reason, and you can leave the company for any reason. And usually there's no notice period. People typically in the United States give a couple of weeks notice as a courtesy, but that's not required. While in Germany, you could have a notice period of like 3 months, you know, before you can start your new group. I think finally, also one of the major differences is the ability to hire international talent. So in Germany, there is the blue card system that's kind of similar to the American green card system or the H-1B visa if people are interested in moving to the United States. The German blue card, in my opinion, is one of the best advantages for Germany. It really provides a very straightforward, easy path to immigration to Germany. And then that can move into permanent residency and then into citizenship at a very accelerated rate compared to other nearby countries like Switzerland or Sweden, for example, which have much longer time periods to get citizenship. The U.S., however, it's a very complicated system. It depends upon what country you're from, whether you enter into a lottery or not, what is your degree or your background. It's not as easy to immigrate into the United States, and it tends to take longer. It sometimes requires the help of like an immigration lawyer in order to accelerate things. So I found that specifically for me, when I was looking to move to Europe, Germany was a very attractive place to move to due to the blue card system for immigration. Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks for that. And regarding the leadership, especially in tech, because you're involved on like a pretty, I would say, senior level engineering leadership positions. So if you compare your approach to building and leading engineering teams in the US versus Europe, do you see some differences, or you do some things different?
Yeah, definitely. So I've worked at a larger companies, as I mentioned before, like at Apple and at Microsoft with hundreds of thousands of engineers in some cases. And I've worked at smaller companies with, you know, just a couple hundred people. And, you know, there's a lot of different ways of approaching in terms of processes, but also between the two locations, between Germany and the United States. So diving into that a little bit further, startups, of course, have a lot more leeway in changing processes. Larger corporations tend to be more structured, a little bit more rigid, less flexibility for being able to change things that might be outside of your direct control. And that's true across both countries. But I've also found that, you know, between kind of like the tech stack and how the companies are operating between the two places, German companies tend to have roles like an agile coach. I haven't seen those in terms of my experience at US-based companies. There are agile coaches, but the agile coach role and having like agile transformations and having fully agile software engineering teams tends to be more standardized and more commonplace in Europe versus the United States. As I mentioned previously, in terms of like compensation, I think that also kind of dives into a little bit of the culture side with that. So, you know, if you have, for example, stock and you're expecting to get that stock and you're going to get what's called stock refreshers, which means additional stock on the following year and the following year after that, that tends to be a way to keep good employees. And it can be a way for a leadership team to retain your top talent by giving them extra levels of stock. In Germany, for example, that isn't always the case, where, you know, you have that leeway for being able to offer that level of stock. There might also be, for example, like salary caps, or, you know, in Silicon Valley, we hear sometimes about the 10x engineer. I sometimes think that's a little bit of a myth, but that means that sometimes, you know, engineers that can do that are really, really good, and they can do maybe a lot more work than maybe the typical engineer. And they're usually compensated accordingly with that. So there can be exceptions for salary. In Germany, it tends to be more equal, I find, and more level set between that. And for me, for myself, when I was a leader in the Berlin area, that places an extra emphasis on, we really need to make a great company culture. We really want to be able to keep our strong talent. And when you have less flexibility in terms of offering stock, for example, we tried a lot to make it where they could have other benefits like learning benefits, or we could offer flexible working hours, or we offered additional in terms of having that level of flexibility. For example, like if somebody's having a baby or somebody's going on a wedding, like we would always try to say people over process with that, and to just try to make it a really great place to work by you know, hiring good people that fit in with our company values and making sure that people were bringing their best selves into the workplace every day was extra critical.
Great, thank you. And you were involved in many hardware projects and the hardware product, so which is not so typical, let's say, on an software engineering, like head of software engineering. But if you could maybe say, tell like other head of engineering that they are thinking about taking this role of a head engineer in a company focused on hardware, what are the differences and maybe what are the critical lessons learned on your end?
Yeah, so to give a little bit of background, my degree when I went to university was in electrical engineering, and I started off my career working at Microsoft in the Xbox hardware team and then moved into the HoloLens team later, doing a hardware development mainly in hardware program management. And then I moved into software engineering leadership roles later. But with my experience of also working in software engineering positions, I've also led teams that were also developing some level of hardware. It just wasn't the main focus for the company. And, you know, the long-running joke is that hardware is hard to make. And I mean, it absolutely is true. Like, if you have an issue with hardware, you know, it's not something that you can just recompile and fix a bug. It usually can take months in order to help to address that. It's also can be very costly to build hardware and to manufacture that hardware at scale. So companies that make hardware tend to, you know, if a software product doesn't work, for example, just you can maybe have new features or pivot for some sprints and try to have other avenues of attracting that level of customers or increasing the usage of the product. While in hardware, you take a lot of big bets, usually millions of dollars, sometimes hundreds of millions, and in some cases, billions of dollars, and lots of people working for many years on a hardware device. And if it doesn't work, I mean, that can be incredible amounts of lost revenue. I think we can all think of products that are hardware related that have done very well in the market, have done not so well in the market. And usually, you know, there can be effects if a product doesn't do well for that. And not a lot of companies, for example, can have the leeway to continue developing that hardware if a hardware device is not successful. So I think that's one level of something to consider is, you know, if you're working in a hardware team in a leadership position, is that you're placing a lot of big bets on developing that hardware, and there will be mistakes. I mean, engineering is all about learning from those mistakes and building the next greatest thing. But it's not easy, and you have to plan out for those level of mistakes. You have to plan out for revisions, and you have to plan out that in case a problem happens, how are we going to be able to address that quickly? So that means that you have to do things like create like a risk register, like, okay, what are we planning that could be risks in this product, and how can we mitigate those risks in advance rather than being reactive? You're trying to be proactive. It can be very capital intensive in terms of requiring like lab space. You have to have physical access for the devices. Where are you going to store these things? If the manufacturing is, let's say, in Asia, you have to have people that are traveling to manufacturing sites, being there on site, working towards making sure that these products are up and running correctly. I mean, you can make a hardware product, but if you're only making, for example, 1 out of 1,000 of them are working correctly that you're building, that's not going to work at scale. You need to be able to make products that are at 95%, 97%, 98% successful in terms of the manufacturing process to make sure that you can build it and not be losing money on every one of the units. And so, you know, these are just different trade-offs with it. I found that when you visit a manufacturing site in China or Japan or Korea, for example, you learn so much in just a couple of days compared to, you know, receiving the hardware and trying to test it or evaluate it in a lab in your home city. So, you know, seeing how people are building up with the product, seeing how it's being manufactured at scale is really valuable. And so if you're working in a hardware team, I recommend having a chance to visit those manufacturing sites. But also remember that hardware is a waterfall product. It's not necessarily agile, and it really can't be agile in the same way that software can. You build it, you test it, and, you know, it goes into a waterfall method where it goes on to the next revision within that. You can have some agile processes sometimes within the teams and their working modes, but it can be hard to be very adaptable, and it's very time consuming to make hardware.
Yeah. And it's probably hard to make any kind of MVP as you can do with the software, right?
Absolutely.
Okay. So, I wanted to tackle your work in Germany. So we recently talked about your work at Vinted, and you mentioned me that you scaled the company up to like 35 people in engineering. Could you elaborate on lessons learned on that, on scaling that fast?
Yeah, so to give a little bit of background, Vinted is headquartered in Lithuania. It's one of the biggest customer-to-customer marketplaces where people can sell, usually clothing, but people can sell toys or other things of their personal belongings and, you know, make some income towards that. And it's great because it provides a second life for these products rather than being put into a landfill, for example. But it's not easy scaling a team. So I was the first engineer that was based in Berlin. They had other engineers that were based in Lithuania, and then I scaled the Berlin-based organization while also managing a team that was also in Lithuania at the same time. And I would say it's not an easy thing. I mean, it's not an easy thing being employee number one in a new place, but there's also cultural differences, you know, between countries. You know, even if we consider like the European Union, for example, values might be different between somebody who is based in Germany versus based in Lithuania. There's other challenges like, for example, Berlin tends to attract international talent. You know, Berlin's a big city. It has a lot of tech companies that are there. There's also the attraction of a lot of the tech companies do happen to speak English, you know, kind of being more of a language for allowing people to migrate and immigrate easily within that and be able to get up to speed and working quickly. And so, you know, like, for example, one of the challenges that we faced was the hiring processes were very different. Like Vinted was very well known as being an amazing employer in Lithuania, but as I was employee number one in Germany, it didn't have that level of history in Germany. And so when we were trying to hire that level of talent within Germany, and we were open for people from other countries, and we would pay for the relocation for them to move to Germany, we realized that our hiring processes were very different. Like, you know, the level of a German hiring process is different than a level of a Lithuanian hiring process, for example, is different. If you're interviewing at some place with a very strong brand recognition, people might be willing to jump through more hoops or go through more stages compared to a company that might be less well-known. And they're like, well, I'm also interviewing at some other places and I'm not necessarily going to jump through all of those steps for that. So I found it really valuable to have a shared mission and a shared understanding of what success is. I mean, you know, a success is not like, let's have an easy interview process. Success is let's hire the right people for the right role as quickly as possible. And how we do that can be different across different locations. You know, I think especially in the last year, year and a half, where the tech market has been different, these values might change. You know, like nowadays we're having 500 people or 1,000 people, you know, applying for a job. That makes it really difficult on, for example, like recruiting teams. Like, okay, well, how are we going to be able to measure what the success is? Like, I mean, we're only going to be hiring 0.01% of the people who apply for this job. And do we have recruiters, for example, that are manually going through all of these things? Or do we have some applicant tracking system that is going through and trying to filter for common keywords? But we could be screening out potentially good candidates. Do we have hiring managers or people on the engineering team also screening out for the right candidates? It's a tough call. I mean, when you're looking at, you know, 1,000 job applications and 1,000 resumes, I mean, things kind of start getting blurry with that, you know? So it happens to be that you really want to be able to attract that right level of talent, and having those common values and that shared mission will help to ensure that you're on the right path towards it.
And based on your experience, you mentioned me last time that you're writing a book about the engineering leadership. And I'm wondering, because you have seen many organizations, you have seen many processes, maybe you have some concepts that might be interesting to other VP head level engineering leaders.
Yeah, definitely. So as you stated, I'm writing a book that will be published by the IEEE here, hopefully within the next, 3 to 6 months, the next couple of quarters. But I think that there's a lot of value in terms of how do we make new leaders? And so that's something that we haven't talked about previously. But that's a core part of the book is that, I truly feel like anyone can be a leader, and a leader is different than a manager within a team. And there's opportunities for leadership within a group. And I found kind of this mistake over and over again that the companies tend to have a great engineer. They could be like the senior engineer, maybe a principal engineer within the team. And they say, okay, your next role now is to go into a management position. And they might not want to move into that. They might not be well suited for that. That might not be what's best for the team, but that's seen as the logical next step within that. And I found some companies that offer like a Y-shaped trajectory for growth. So people tend to go from like junior, mid, senior engineer, and then they can move down a path for an individual contributor for going from like, for example, to principal to maybe a technical fellow or other additional levels that might be offered in the company. And then the other side to the Y track is a management track going down manager, then to director, then to like a VP level if that's offered. And having those levels of opportunities for people's growth is really valuable. I mean, one of the biggest mistakes companies can make is having somebody in a management position that doesn't want to be a manager, and especially if like you have a manager that might be managing a team of 8 people initially, or in some cases, if you have a flat hierarchy, it could be 20 people reporting to this person. And most people leave their jobs due to their manager. They're not really leaving due to the work, usually. If another company offers them 5 or 10% more pay, a lot of people will just choose to stay in their current company, unless there's a huge salary difference, and then people usually go for that. But, for normal reasons of why people leave a company, it's usually due to their manager. And, people will stay also because of their manager. And having a person who is in a management position that's been well suited for success, for example, like maybe they have managed an intern, or maybe they have taken leadership training, or they've become having an interest in terms of like the people level problems, and they've started implementing like a feedback culture within their team. These are just a few concrete examples of how an individual can show that level of leadership potential in a management track. And if it's something that aligns with what they want to do, and you can give them kind of like those baby steps of helping to mentor other new employees within the team, or helping out with an internship over a summer, those can be low risk endeavors to make sure that this person wants to do that role and will be well suited within that, and help to ensure that this isn't just like the logical track for that person, but instead is the right track for that person, and making sure that it's not going to open up a lot more issues if you have the wrong manager in place. So that's just an area that I focus more on within the book. But it's so critical for making sure that a company's culture is great.
Yeah, I think it's great. Like a small steps, you can just try it out if it is something for you, and you could have like a feedback for yourself sometimes, right? Especially the newcomers, right? The guys who are new in their role. It makes totally sense.
Yeah.
Joel, I'm wondering, I'm always asking my guests about the biggest challenges that they have. And in your case, as a VP of engineering, or what do you usually search on Google, or what do you ask your mentors regarding your challenges?
Yeah, for sure. I think, it's a hard question because I think, everybody's going to make mistakes, right? And everybody's going to be learning from those mistakes. And the question, I think, and what makes a great leader is like, how do they adapt to those mistakes? And how do they make sure that those mistakes aren't repeated, ideally, and that they're learning from that, but also that they can help give insights into others for helping to make sure that also that they can be successful in their things. I mean, in engineering, nobody's going to be perfect, and the product will never be perfect. And there's always levels of trade-offs between these two areas. Personally for me, I find that some of the biggest challenges are that, especially as I've led larger teams of of a few hundred people, for example, that were within my organization, is you're not going to make everyone happy, you know, with anything that happens. I mean, you could be like, hey, we're going to offer free food. I don't know, as an example, they're going to be like, yeah, I'm not happy. I like bringing my lunch in, or the lunch is unhealthy options. I don't know, you know, as an example, but it's like, you will not make, you know, 200 people happy with anything. What I try to do is to communicate clearly and often and be transparent and welcome feedback for myself and create a feedback culture within the engineering organization. I find that that brings a lot of success. So diving into that a little bit further, you know, there's levels of transparency that are allowed, I think, and not allowed within an organization. And so, for example, like, let's say we have an underperformer within the organization, and it's somebody that we decide that should no longer be within the group. Like, that's a very hard decision that we don't take lightly. It can take weeks or sometimes even months of discussions and back and forth and trying to give people like a performance development plan, opportunities to improve, giving people the benefit of the doubt, you know, gathering feedback to make sure that there's not a bias within those thoughts for that employee. And, you know, this is the level of openness and a transparent process of how this would be done. But the reason why somebody, for example, might leave a company or might not be the best suited for working at the employer, that's a private thing, you know, and that's not something necessarily that should be shared amongst, you know, all members of the organization. That's something between, you know, their manager and maybe their skip level manager and the employee directly. So, you know, it has to be that right, healthy balance, I think, between that. But I mean, other areas, for example, is, you know, sometimes there has to be some tough decisions. Maybe the business isn't doing as well and some people need to be let go, but it's like, okay, how are we going to be making this decision? Like, are there other areas that we can do in order to reduce down costs, for example, rather than letting someone go for a layoff? So for example, like, could we maybe cut one of the benefits, or can we not do a company trip or a summit together and instead, you know, postpone that in order to help to save additional jobs within the company? I mean, these are things that, like, I find that should not be done at just a one person VP level, you know, in a silent place. But if you're having that discussion and being transparent about what the problems are with the management team or with the leadership team or with, you know, senior engineers, you can come up with a lot of good ideas about how different things have happened. I'll give some concrete examples. Like, I was working in one company and we had a lot of cloud costs. And I mean, the company was doing okay. And you know, there wasn't any layoffs that were expected, but it was like, wow, you know, like, we're spending upwards of $20,000 a month for this one team specifically. And there's a lot of teams in this company on cloud computing costs. This seems like it's like, you know, an order of magnitude higher than others. We want to look into this. And of course, there was thoughts or feelings about like, oh, are we spending too much money on this team? Is this team not producing the value that these costs would be expected for that? You know, and it can worry people. But if you're communicating clearly that, no, like, we're not planning to let anyone go, we're just trying to get to the root cause of this problem. And then the team investigated it for a couple of weeks and they found that, for example, like, we were doing too many backups, probably for what we were trying to build. And those backups were honestly really costly. It took up a lot of compute power and compute time. And we were able to reduce down our cloud computing costs pretty significantly within this team by just changing the number of backups that we were doing to be less. And I mean, that was a win-win, you know? So that was something that, like, we just, as a leader, shined a light onto this problem. And then the engineering teams were able to come up with a good solution towards it, rather than saying like, oh, it must be this, and we're now going to go with these more drastic options. So I find that, you know, within an engineering leadership role, you're kind of always facing like these levels of challenges and these trade-offs. But my style has always been to be transparent and to try to work collaboratively with it wherever possible.
And it comes like really well to my next question, because I really wanted to ask you about any strong opinions that you have about building the teams, products, maybe software delivery, the processes around it that might be unpopular, but they works for you, right? So maybe there's something.
I found that organizations that tend to do agile very structured and in a very like rigorous manner without having the ability to kind of be flexible towards those levels of processes. Those organizations haven't been, in my opinion, as successful as ones that have used Agile as a framework and to try to kind of adopt it as needed within the team. Diving into that a little bit further, I've worked in organizations, for example, that have used, like, some teams will have Kanban, some teams will have sprints, some teams will use, you know, their own kind of mixture of different processes for doing that software development. I think that's okay. You know, teams can adopt and teams can go into those forming, storming, norming, performing stages. You know, teams can have a level of maturity that suits certain areas better than others. If some teams, for example, might have more junior level employees, having kind of more structure or more rigidness can be beneficial, but, you know, it's not necessarily always like the right thing. But from a leadership perspective, for example, like if you have some teams that are working on, for example, a 2-week cadence for their sprints, and you have other teams that are working on a 1-month or a 6-week cadence for their sprints, that can be a difficult thing in terms of being able to oversee how is the progress developing, what kind of risks are happening, how many checkpoints are going on to ensure that the team is on track. So, like, for example, within my level, within that, I would have tried to ease the teams into doing like a standardized timeline for their sprints, like every 2 weeks. But if they're using Kanban and they're giving updates every 2 weeks, then that's also an acceptable way of doing it. For myself, I've gone through Agile training, of course. I've worked in organizations that have had Agile coaches. You know, sometimes in terms of having Scrum Masters and Agile coaches, and do you have one Agile coach for two teams, or do you have an organizational Agile coach for 100 engineers and you only have one, and they're kind of balancing their time between all of them? I've seen it work in both cases, and I've seen it not work in both cases. I think that really depends upon the individual Agile coaches. How do they best foresee the organization? Sometimes, for example, like some organizations don't have the budget to hire an Agile coach, one per team. Sometimes an engineer might double serve as an Agile coach, and they might not be the best Agile coach, but, you know, having something that's there to help out a team through the Agile processes a bit, at least for part of their time, can give them some experience that they might not have otherwise had, and help the teams have something better than nothing, for example, in that area. So I have also seen, for example, that in some organizations, when you're having Agile, that, like, if you're having a retrospective, that's where the teams are very open, ideally, and honest about what's working, that's not working over the last 2 weeks, and help to do constant improvements. I've worked in environments where engineering managers always attend those meetings, and I've worked in environments where they do not, kind of by design. So I'm kind of more of a fan of do not attend those retrospectives. I want the teams to be as open as possible. If you have your engineering manager or in that group, that people might not be as open or as transparent as maybe you want it to be. Of course, you're always trying to create a transparent culture, but you know, that creates a different dynamic when you have your manager there. So I would only attend those meetings if I was specifically invited to attend for a specific topic that might be of relevancy to me, and the team was all accepting of me being there. But 99% of the time, I would not attend those by design, and attended to work out well. But, you know, I would just make sure that those expectations were set from the beginning. So, those are just some areas where I found being a little bit more flexible has worked out very well.
Yeah, thanks for that. My experience with Agile coaches is following that those guys who are pragmatic, they are really great to work
right
with. But those guys who are crazy about the Agile, they need to do everything by the book. It didn't work out really well,
right?
From my experience,
yeah, agreed.
John, and last but not least, I wanted to really ask you about any book, conferences, or resources that I recommend to fellow tech leaders that were particularly helpful for you in your journey.
Yeah, for sure. So in my experience, I'm an American, and I only hold American citizenship. I only speak English. And coming into Germany, you know, that's a different environment. I mean, I felt very welcomed in terms of, German culture, like the visa process, and you know, my team and my colleagues when I first joined, they were very helpful, but it's not an easy thing. And I also struggled with I had worked with many international people that had moved to the United States and were working in the US environments previously. And the US environment is very different than a German environment or a Lithuanian environment or a Ukrainian environment, for example. And I struggled sometimes, for example, like I do things in an American style. You know, I had worked in the US and grown up in the United States. So I'll give you one concrete example is like, I was doing my one-on-ones with as a new engineering manager within my team. You know, I just started a few weeks earlier, getting to know everyone, and my American style was to kind of like form those, I guess, those soft relationships first. So I'd be like, "Oh, how are you? You know, how is when did you join, and how are you liking things?" And just kind of like, you know, establishing that it's not always just about like, okay, let's do A, B, and C and get it done. It's like, I wanted to kind of form that style. And I remember an employee telling me when I first joined, they're like, "I know you're an American and I know you kind of like to sugarcoat things, but tell me when I'm doing wrong and I will fix it." And I was like, "Whoa, I don't think you're doing anything wrong. I think you're doing great. I mean, you just started. Yeah, like let's consider that later, you know?" But they're used to like very directness. And I know a lot of times in the German culture also, like they appreciate that level of directness. Like that's what they expect from a manager is like, tell me what I need to improve on and then I will do those actions. But that's not the way I've done management previously. And that's not like also my background. But I also realized that, hey, I'm working in Germany and I'm working with German colleagues and German employees. And so I need to cater my language, my style, my mannerisms towards that local audience. Like I'm in their culture, like they're not in my culture. And so I found that I needed to get up to speed in terms of how to best be able to approach that and learn from that and then take that accordingly. So I'm a fan of the book Culture Map, which breaks down a little bit about different cultures. I mean, everybody's different and there's nuances, of course, with every culture. So there's some generalizations, of course, within the book. But it helps to be able to best understand, you know, from at least from a high level, like, oh, okay, I have an employee from Poland. You know, what is Polish working culture like? Or I just had somebody that just moved from Portugal to Berlin. How can I best make sure that they're successful? Are they used to different working styles? You know, like there can be different things like, what time do people join a meeting, right? Like Germans tend to be at the meeting on time, which I tended to like really respect and value later. I mean, Americans, we would tend to start meetings like, you know, 5 minutes late. I mean, some countries start meetings maybe 10 or 15 minutes late, you know, they're going to go grab a coffee and there's just kind of the expectation. So it's like, okay, as we're an organization with a lot of different people from a lot of different backgrounds and cultures, that's a beautiful thing. And how do we make sure that this works and kind of set alignment within that? Also, I find that one of the biggest challenges with engineering leadership is delegation. And this is sometimes overlooked in terms of engineering leaders might take a lot on themselves to be like, okay, I have to do all of this stuff, or engineers, or maybe an engineering manager or somebody would have certain expectations that certain things might be done by them, but instead it's being done by a director or a VP. And you know, that can cause conflict. It can cause confusion. And delegation poker is something from the Management 3.0 training. And it's such a simple tool. I mean, if you look at it for 5 minutes, you'll get it and you'll understand it. But I completely recommend it because it's not something that you have to pay for. You can just go to the Management 3.0 website, look at the delegation poker, and you can just like print it out. But basically, it's on a scale of 1 through 7 about a level of delegation. And it could be, hey, I'm going to do everything myself. Nobody else has an input into it. And on the other side of it, it's, I don't care what the answer is. Everything is just completely delegated. You don't need to communicate anything to me. And then the other numbers are everything kind of in between on a scale within that. And if you have a new project, if you have a new objective, I mean, it could be something as simple as like, hey, we want to get team t-shirts. Okay, fine. Like, how is that going to be delegated? Like, what parts of that are going to be delegated to different individuals? that can be very empowering because you can have people that then, you know, raise their hand and say, I want to do this. That's amazing. Like, I mean, these are the people that are going to, you know, find the time to be able to do it. They're going to be excited to do it rather than being seen as a chore, just an additional task on their already overloaded plate. And having that also be an opportunity where the leader can, instead of being stretched too thin across a lot of different things, making sure that things are delegated and making sure that, I mean, what the beauty of delegation poker is that it's clear, it's concise, and it's well understood. You can say, okay, we're going to do a number three on this activity. Number three means A, B, and C, making sure that that level is well understood amongst all of the parties can ensure that one, that like the manager or the leader is getting that level of responsibilities delegated, and it can help an employee to grow and learn as well. But it also makes sure that there's not that level of confusion, which can also cause delays within a delivery of a program or a project. So I'm a big fan of using that tool, and I recommend it to any of your listeners.
Awesome. Thank you very much, John. This was my last question. Thank you for your insights, especially about the culture. It's something that I will probably recall and remember a lot about the differences. So thank you for sharing all of your lessons learned.
Thank you, Matt, for having me. I really appreciate your time.